Hello, everyone, and welcome to our first podcast episode. And we've decided to call our podcast Disorganized by TME. And my name is Nick, or Nicholas, and I'm joining you here from Lund with another colleague.
Yeah, I'm Carl Palmos. I'm joining from the Johanna Berg campus at Chalmers.
So this podcast is designed to inform basically a couple different audiences. Disorganized is all about looking under the hood into the details of our work, of our research projects at a Swedish technical university. And we're going to do that through two different ways. And the first idea is really just to kind of present the research projects that PhD students, that younger researchers in particular, are working on. And we would also like to add to that kind of conversation, what are more practical applications, what are wider ranging, more core cross-cutting issues that these kinds of more technical discussions bring up to ourselves, but also to a very wide-ranging public sort of audience. So that way anyone and everyone can tune in to Disorganized and hopefully get something really interesting and thought-provoking out of our little talks. So the podcast, Disorganized, at the moment we're going to proceed from more of a conversational format. So we will introduce the podcast. And then after the introduction, we will have a real taped conversation, basically, sort of an interview. But instead of a technical interview, we will be interviewing in more of a journalistic sense with the researchers who will be our special guests, who may or may not actually return in later episodes of the podcast. That remains to be decided. So you can consider Disorganized to be a very disorganized and conversational podcast.
Yeah, and this is the first time we're doing it, so, it might evolve over time. This is a prototype.
Exactly. Consider this a very disorganized prototype of Disorganized.
So I guess without further ado, let's move on to the first person that we'll be talking to in this podcast series. Who is this?
Yes, our first guest from this first episode is going to be Charlotta Kronblad, or Lotta as we affectionately call her. And she is a PhD student who is getting close to defending her thesis at our department at TME.
Right, let's listen to the interview.
Yes, enjoy. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to our first podcast together. We are here today to talk about the issue called digitalization and the law. Our guest today is Charlotta Kronblad, or Lotta, as we call her. Say hello, Lotta.
Hello.
I might as well say hi as well. This is Carl.
Yes. So as I've mentioned, today we're going to be discussing for about the next 45 minutes or the next hour issues surrounding digitalization and the law or legal practice. So Lotta, if you could just explain to us a little bit how you got interested in this issue. How does the legal practice have anything to do with computers and digitalization? Because for me, when I think about digitalization, a lot of the time I think about apps and phones, so I'm thinking that this is something to do with maybe what's going on at Chalmers Lindholmen, which is to say that someone's building a fancy app that makes it easier to pay our fines or maybe do virtual court appearances or maybe not even do Zoom court appearances at all. Because I think some of us can remember a few months ago when it was reported that even the Zoom lawyers are struggling with their children's filters. So we have the off chance that the Zoom filters show cats and other cute things instead of the lawyers. So anyways, the question is what does digitalization have to do with the law? In short, so let's start with digitalization.
I would start, I mean, a lot earlier than these applications that you talk about, and really think, what is the law about? It's really about handling a lot of information and treating information and situation according to a general rule. So that's very much connected to digitalization, I think. And also when you think about it, legal practice is very much something that's has to do with intellectual work. And digitalization has a lot to do with handling information, but also creating intellectual thinking in an abstract or a technical way. So artificial intelligence, for instance, if you can produce the kind of value that or thinking that is key to legal value creation in an artificial manner, then you can create value around the clock. You could have lawyers working without being hungry, tired, or bored, and you could create value all the time and scale it up. So it's more that kind of thinking about what is really legal practice and how can you create value from that.
Okay, and so how do we go from creating value to some sort of digitalization, right? Because as we all know, we think of legal practice, we think of the law, we think of courthouses, we think of lawyers, we think of physical places, people going back and forth. We think of the hassle of jury duty, maybe. We think of going and dealing with the security guard, trying to figure out where we park our car, who's going to pick up the kids.
I think that's interesting because that is all about to change. And that's actually a shift that happened the last year with COVID. That since the court started to close down as a place, they have become more symbols of what they really entail. And we have started to need to reconsider what is the court? Is it a place or is it a provider of justice? And if it's a service provider of justice, then it doesn't have to be a place at all. Then you can think of it in several different ways. And actually, we are now seeing virtual courts all around the world, and we are seeing people not having to go to the courthouse to hustle with security, but you actually just you identify via your kind of bank ID or just some questions, and then you're in the courtroom remotely, so you're remotely accessing it. So we are rethinking law.
We have actually seen that funny episode of the court, the digital court, where the is it a witness or some kind of a juror who has the filter of a rabbit or a cat or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that was a lawyer, and he didn't know how to put it off, so he just kept it on. That's all the kind of COVID, you're getting used to stuff. But I think that this represents a major shift in society when you start to think of the court as a service and not as a place. It really makes it possible to rearrange the entire court system, because if you don't need to have a courthouse in every city, you could instead organize the courts according to competence areas, and you could perhaps have more efficient trials for certain cases, and you wouldn't have the same queues for everything, but you could have more quality or judges that actually know the legal areas, because now all judges have to know of every piece of law. But if we rearrange the courts, you could have law judges that are actually knowledgeable in digitalization, because this is also a legal area that's on the rise. And the judges today don't have the competence to handle these new cases and the new kind of evidence that's coming in their way.
Okay, let's go back a bit. Let's go back to this idea of the law as a service provider. So let's go back to everyday people needing to have some access to the law. Right? Because when we talk about service providers, generally we start thinking of a lot of negative connotations. We maybe can think about postal services and how small towns don't have easy access to the post, or even talk about doctor's offices and issues with access there. So what about access, right? If we go from this idea of having of having our normal, nice brick marble sort of ideal of a courthouse. And then we go to the idea of the courthouse becoming digital and having the law being serviced to us digitally.
Via this.
What is the implication? Yeah. What is the practical implication? Let's start with Sweden. Access.
But I think in Sweden, I mean, we have one of the most developed IT infrastructures in the world. It wouldn't be much of a problem to have the courthouse in as an app in our smartphone or access it via remotely. We also have Bank ID, many of us. I mean, it would be rather easy to develop this in a very safe, systematic way. But then I was talking to a judge in Brazil about this, and he said that because I was raising the same kind of concerns that I think that you were alluding to, like, okay, so this works in Sweden because we have so built out the infrastructure for IT, but what about the remote areas of Brazil? But he said, like, well, I'm a judge in the remote areas, but what I do is I take my computer, I jump onto this donkey, and I take this donkey out to those remote villages in the mountains, and I bring them justice. Because all that's needed is really my computer. I don't need the fancy courthouse. I bring the courthouse on my computer to the people. So he was talking a lot about this idea of a democratization of the law by using digital and not needing to have everyone connected by their own cell phone, but actually thinking differently about the service being provided. Like a doctor coming to you instead of you having to go to the hospital.
But let's take that up, because if we think about the doctor and the doctor's office, we've been hearing a lot over the last, actually longer than a decade, probably about two decades or maybe even going back into the 90s, we've been hearing a lot about the hype of making your medical records go digital, right? Being able to easily transfer your digital records from place to place if you move between countries and having that ease of access. And that doesn't seem to be working out that way. So what kind of situation does it look like for the legal case? Is it secure? Is it not secure? What's the question we should be asking?
There we have the problem of the legal content of integrity issues and GDPR putting kind of the limits to what can be transferred across borders, who can store what and where, and all these kind of issues. But really, I don't see for the law as such, or for the institutions supporting the legal system and the law, I don't see any problems with doing this, really. I think that we must be a lot more. And I was actually involved in a design thinking project at the court in Helsingborg, where we tried to target the court services of the future, where we kind of tried to think with... We had 60 people there, different kind of professionals and so on, to kind of work up how do the people, the citizens that we serve with justice, how do they want to access justice? How do they want their access to the law? And we try to think about it in new ways. And I think that needs to be done much more from the lawyers. We need to move away from the set institutions and reconsider what we're really doing.
I'm just thinking, going back to the medical example, yes, the medical records have not been digitalized as one would might have expected, but there's still the idea of having, you know, speaking to your doctor over the phone or mm-hmm. over some kind of video link thing.
Yeah, and that has really
using, right?
Yeah, and that has really opened up the space for also talking about accessing judges or lawyers via apps. Or, I mean, once we're used to doing that, why not do the legal stuff? And I would say, I just did my kind of tax return or, you know, the declaration stuff. And you do that online using your bank ID. So, I mean, why not do a testimony or an agreement with someone in the same fashion? Why would we need to go and see a physical lawyer to help us with that? Why not use a system as we do with so many other institutions in society? So I think we need to have an updated kind of view on how to access the law, how to access justice.
I think one parallel example that we could compare with would be the kind of the digitalization of democracy, or the so-called e-democracy. I remember one of my first jobs was to work with e-democracy in the European Commission. So we had a big room with, it must have been 14 computers. So we had one sort of internet relay chat channel per language. And there would be questions coming in from IRC chatters across Europe, asking questions to a European commissioner. Mm-hmm. And then there would be responses, right? So those were some of the experiments going on in so-called e-democracy then. But then there's still that question there with democracy, that you have these, you know, theories or ideas of democracy going back, 2,000 years at least, to this idea of democracy being played out on a square somewhere, like a physical meeting. And I would imagine that you would have the same thinking about that physical meeting place, you know, the one in marble or whatever, the honorable place, old, big, heavy stone stuff.
The symbols,
the symbols of eternity and so forth. That you know, you have those in democracy, but you also, I guess, have those in when it comes to law and justice. But are there parallels there, and what can we learn from them, do you think?
I think there are a lot of parallels, but I also think that when we talk about democracy, we need to understand that for a functioning kind of westernized democracy, the legal system is crucial in kind of making sure that powers are not being kind of abusive towards the people. And also important in that kind of balance, where the legal system is a pillar for democracy, we also have journalism, and the free press is another pillar. And I would say that digitalization right now is changing that quite a lot. So we have fake news, we have a new kind of situation for the press and for journalists, and that is also changing how the law and how we can kind of handle that, because it's all disrupting the kind of pillars of democracy. So we need to reconsider the entire system for this, and we need to ensure that the law is actually being developed in line with the kind of trends in society. So that it's not just a static pillar and everything else is changing, but this is static and then everything falls. So we need to kind of adjust it to be aligned with it, with the other developments in society. So, because, I mean, the law is nothing. It's an intellectual construction of our current ideals. But it's vital for a functioning democracy. So if we want to keep democracy, which is kind of at risk at the moment, we need to ensure that the law is effective and qualitative and aligned with it. And I think that legal practice needs to become much more efficient and qualitative and answering to the needs of the people, because otherwise they will go elsewhere to get that. So we need to be better and to kind of comprehend what the law is and what we can use it for, and maybe use a more of a design perspective and come in and reconsider the entire kind of institution of it and see how if we started fresh today, how would we do it? And then, of course, it's always tricky to change something that's so institutionalized as the law. But I don't think that's a reason not to think about it.
That brings us to a really great point. Who gets to digitalize the law, right? Because we've been talking about that very passively up to now. We've just been assuming that this is something that should happen and is happening in other fields. Mm. Because I say this very much in the context that Horlotta here is working, has been working on a lawsuit that's a bit related to this. So could you give us some more details on who is digitalizing the law? And more importantly, maybe, who's not? Who's being shut out of that conversation?
I mean, in this kind of lawsuit, which is really, I mean, some kind of activist... research activist work, is that I'm trying out to see if the justice system can really handle the digitalization as it is ongoing today. Can the courts handle algorithm as pieces of evidence? Do they understand what an algorithm is if you put it in front of a judge? And sadly to say, it's not really working out as it should. So it's really exposing that we have a lack of justice in society. And as our municipalities and administrations are becoming more and more digitalized, we need to have better guardians for the citizens to ensure that they are being treated correctly. But when the judges won't allow us to present algorithmic evidence, or they don't get it and they don't want to look at it, then we don't have a kind of justice in society, because then you can't make your voices heard. And I think this is an extremely important and problematic area, as I know the city of Gothenburg is trying to centralize and kind of digitalize elderly care and social services. And for sure, they're going to use algorithm for decision making. And when you can't appeal those decisions in the courts, it's really problematic. So that's what I'm trying to show in this kind of lawsuit, which is about school placements caused by a faulty algorithm.
So you're trying to raise the profile of issues of bias and transparency in these algorithms, or?
Yeah, not really bias, but faulty use of it. Because when the municipalities, they are normally lacking tech competence. They are adding these kind of algorithmic decision-making systems to increase efficiency, increase justice, but they don't know how to do it. So they just kind of apply it. And when it goes wrong, no one is taking responsibility for that, because then they blame the tech, and the technology is generally not wrong. It does what you tell it to do. But if you tell it to do illegal stuff, it will do illegal stuff. But if the judges are not equipped to assess the legality of it, then that leaves the people with injustice. And I think that's what happened with this school placement case. The 2,000 kids were placed at the wrong places, and they are still not having justice.
I was just about to say that maybe it's for those of us who are not, I mean, you and I, Charlotte, are very much into the whole school placement system in Gothenburg, but the case study is then from the Gothenburg municipality, right? Maybe we should say something about...
So, Gothenburg city has the largest school area in Sweden, because the entire city is just one school area. So, for instance, Stockholm has 6 school areas or something like that. But so Gothenburg handles 50,000 kids, and each year it's 12,000 kids up for elections. So you elect what school to go to, and then, you're placed by the municipality in the school of your choice, but there's also a geographical parameter to it. So you should be not, if you choose a place where someone else lives closer, that person have the right to go there. So it's two different parameters, parental choice and geography. And what they did was they tried to make it more efficient, this system. So they bought a system and they told the algorithm to place the kids at the nearest school. It was just one problem, that they instructed it to use the bird's eye view, while the law says you should use the walking distance. So the problem was that about maybe 200 kids that live on one side of the river were placed on the opposite side of the river, which is really easy for a bird to commute that way. But for the kids, it was hours in traffic to get there to the school. So, and what happened with those placements was that they knocked out the kids that were supposed to go to that school on the other side of the river, that then had to go to a third school further inland, and those were knocked out, the kids that were supposed to go there, to another school. So this was repeated, this kind of domino effect, in 6 different turns or multiple turns, so that 2,000 kids or something were affected by this kind of faulty instruction to the algorithm. Place them at the nearest school where it should be. Place them at the school where they have the shortest walking distance. So that's 2,000 kids on a kind of faulty algorithmic use. But they still haven't corrected it. The kids still go to that other school. So,
can I ask you, because my sense of watching this on the news, it was all, like you said, no one was really taking responsibility, but no one was really saying either that, oh, we put this algorithm to play and it didn't really perform very well. We're sorry, you know, we should do something. Like, so it just became this kind of black hole that of dysfunction. But like, it's a bit weird. Like, so there was no, in this particular case, there was no bureaucrat that could be blamed for this, but there was no blame on the computer system either. Or how?
But I mean, the computer system just did what they told it to do. So I mean, it really, it's nothing wrong with that computer system at all, and it's not complicated. It's a very, in fact, easy system to understand, but never to say that the people that used it didn't understand it. And the only thing, I mean, that I came in contact with this because my kid was affected by it. And so all of a sudden I started to kind of re-engineer this kind of, and I was looking at all these crazy placements and I tried to like, but this can't be legal. What have they done? And I started to kind of retrace, and we were a group of 12 parents living in this neighborhood that was affected by this. And so we kind of all pooled our resources and competences and kind of started to understand what had happened. And I mean, it's not a very complicated story when you actually start to kind of get into it and understand what had happened. But it took the municipality about a year to get to the same point as we had gotten over summer. And I mean, the auditor's report for the city auditors of Gothenburg just came up with their reports in January and confirmed everything that we thought was true. That it was, in fact, faulty instructions to the algorithm. It was also that they didn't instruct it to optimize on parental choice, which the law says you have to do. It was several cases of faulty school addresses. So, I mean, the entire system was kind of faulty. And I mean, the school said, oh, we corrected 450 faulty ones. But what I'm saying is this is all in one system. They did one running of the system. And if 450 were faulty, it means that every single placement decision is faulty because they all depend on each other, like in that domino effect that I talked about. So I my case that I'm presenting then to the in the lawsuit is that you cannot do these kind of systems if you're not aware of what you're doing. If you're not competent enough, you shouldn't do it. And that's but then of course the judges don't want to look at the algorithm as evidence, which is also the problem then, because they don't. And also, I wouldn't know what to do with the algorithm if I got it, because you really need a test environment to kind of test it and see if, when you do this kind of running in this environment with this information, what happens. And I would say that the courts today are not equipped to do this kind of testing or evaluate evidence in this kind of fashion. So it's really problematic. And I hope that my kind of research will kind of show that this is a problem and we need to deal with this. Yeah, so I'm hoping that this will actually be my next career step to go ahead and do this as a postdoc, to research this more thoroughly. What happens in these kind of instances?
So just to follow up there though, does this mean that if there is blame, then that blame should be placed on the developers? So, because I assume that this system was procured by a private consultancy? Was it an in-house thing?
No, it was an outside company, but I mean, they just instruct it did exactly what it was supposed to do. So it's no blame to the technology or the company that did that, but all the blame on the people that instructed it faulty. And this is also why I think lawyers need to be much more involved in technology development and be there when you program the stuff. Because otherwise, I mean, the person at the administration that programmed this, they were just like thinking, oh, but the nearest school, that's what you should program. So they instructed them to program it that way. It should have been a lawyer knowing that, but in Swedish school legislation, the wording is not geographical closeness, it is walking distance. And if they had said that, that would have been what would have been in the program or in the algorithm. So you really need to have the lawyers there working with the tech people when they do this, when they code. Because afterwards, it's already too late. So lawyers need to get involved more. And this is also something I think is problematic, because lawyers are lawyers because they don't like tech. They don't want to collaborate with these people. And that's also problematic. So we need lawyers and tech people to talk more to each other and collaborate a lot more moving forward.
So what you're saying here is essentially that while it's very easy to point the finger, to point blame at the algorithm, at these lines of code that are doing this, but what you're saying is that that's easy to do, but it's actually much more important to have a contextual understanding and to look at it's this composition of perhaps lawyers, judges, municipal workers at Gothenburg that aren't able to both understand what the algorithm is doing and challenge the results in real time, because not everyone is able to file lawsuits when they see these kinds of things happening. Many of us don't know these things happen, right? Those children were crossing the river every day. They didn't know. They didn't know that they were supposed to be going to another school that would have saved their commute time, right? Yeah. So who should be held accountable? Because these things do happen, and we can assume with the rise of technical democracy that these things are only going to become more commonplace.
Well, I'm working on some pieces that we look into this, and we talk about discovering the politics of algorithms and kind of unveiling who are they benefiting, for what purpose, what are they actually doing, so you put the algorithm in the context, because it's not about technology, it's about people and implementation. And that is, it is tricky, but it is something that we need to talk a lot more about, because we use algorithms for so many things today. And we leave it up to the tech people to write them and to have kind of the power over that domain. But I think lawyers and other people discussing ethics and societal implications need to be much more involved in this development.
And presumably, I guess you're also saying that engineers should be more involved in the stuff that the lawmakers are involved in, say ethics, functioning of society, and so forth.
Exactly.
Obviously, plugging what we do at TME and as academics as well. But sorry, I'll let you respond.
Yeah, but that's one point that I'm making, because I teach law to our students. So in their third year, they are having me for one of the classes, and one of the purposes with that class is not kind of to teach them the content of the law, but to teach them legal language and teach them not to put lawyers on pedestals that you don't talk to unless it's gone too far and it's already too late and the problem is already there, but to actually create a common language so that you can talk to each other and kind of reach further together than you would have by not collaborating. So that's one of the most important things I think there is to be a teacher, to actually have this kind of cross-disciplinary encounters with the students.
But if we just kind of quickly go back to the lawsuit, I'm curious, what does a good outcome look like for your side, from your side of things, from your position? What are you looking to achieve?
I'm looking to achieve some kind of public debate about this, because I think that it's quite disturbing that often when you start to digitalize things in society, you start with the weaker subjects. So it's the people in need of social services, it's the elderly, it's the kids. You use these algorithmic decisions in these instances, and they need to be protected by someone. And I think that the courts need to be aware that these systems are out there, and that they need to have more competences to actually deal with these issues. So it's just an awareness thing, because, I mean, the the kids are already placed. The city already changed the rule for the coming year, and they are not going to make these mistakes again, because it did make national news, and I mean, it's been a large debate about it. So the problem is in a way solved for this instance, but it's not solved for society as a whole. We need to still kind of be alert to these kind of situations popping up everywhere. And I mean, it was quite a funny coincidence that I was one of the parents that was affected by this, because had it happened the year before, when I didn't have a kid who was going to be placed in grade 7, I would never have known about it, and it would just pass. So I'm just thinking, how many of those decisions are there out there in society that are unjust and unlawful and faulty, and we just don't know about them, and no one is taking responsibility, and it will not be justice served. So
I'd like to kind of extend this discussion a bit, because we've been talking about the law and legal practice as moving or upgrading from the marble courthouse and all the kind of stereotypes and good and bad things that comes with it, to moving to the donkey in Brazil and on the laptop going to the farmer or whoever in Brazil. We think about this kind of digitalization, but we haven't really been thinking about, outside of the algorithm, we haven't been thinking about the content of the law and the possibility for change there. But we've been talking a lot about issues of access, security, equity, and you've also been discussing a bit of an interest in looking more into the future and anticipating changes in the legal fabric. So do you have any thoughts on changes to the content of the law as a result of this digitalization? Because it sounds like it is a huge shift to be able to go to talk to the judge over Zoom jury duty from the safety of home. But is there anything more there that's happening?
Yeah, I'm thinking, and this also comes from some conversations that I had with scholars and judges in Brazil, which is quite also funny, because COVID made us all being home for conference and so on. But I still managed to make these friends in Brazil, a bunch of judges and scholars that are very much into discussing kind of the future of the law and what we should do with the legal kind of framework. And one thing that we talked about is the entire notion of law being, or justice being done in kind of retrospect. We deal with issues or cases that come up, and these judges were talking about, why don't we use our knowledge and our roles as judges to prevent problems, prevent these kind of lawsuits and trouble between people and conflict. So they had started some kind of a more like a pedagogical kind of community around teaching people how to collaborate in a better sense. And so we started to talk about, why not create intellectual kind of platforms or infrastructures that build in the legal framework and kind of enable people to do the right thing from start. So you would collaborate on platform where the legal framework is already programmed or built into it. So when you use that, you will not get into a dispute afterwards. So kind of prevention of disputes instead of handling the disputes. And that we as lawyers and judges should be much more involved in that. And this is something that I talked to some people that study kind of the built of smart cities. And we are so good at putting the material objects in efficient flows, and we are very much interested in creating infrastructures for efficient flows of material goods. But what about the intellectual infrastructure? We should do something similar to kind of help us to navigate in these intellectual and legal spaces and to avoid disputes. And that's something that I think is also a mind shift and kind of a new way of thinking about the law. But I think it's valid and should be researched a lot more.
It sounds a bit like sort of agile conflict prevention, agile dispute prevention or something. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, the world that we live in is sort of like a computer game. And in computer games, a lot of the choices that are made are already kind of pre-programmed what you can do. And if we could be somehow not restricted by the law, but aided by it to know what is the legal choice in this, maybe that could help us. Yeah, so to look at the world more with those kind of glasses and understand that we are, because the law is not a textbook of a set guide of rules, but it is intellectual constructions that are constantly changing, which is also why lawyers have these kind of upholded positions, because it's changing so much. No normal person, just a, you know, regular person, you can't keep up with all the content in the law because it's so much, it's so complex, and it's constantly changing. So you need the lawyer. But what if you make it more simple? What if you make it more accessible from the first place, and you can avoid all this doing the wrong things and reaching conflicts and disputes? Maybe we could have another path, a more peaceful path moving forward.
So now I'm thinking of previous movements along the lines of democratizing technology. And now it sounds like you're arguing for us to couple that conversation with democratizing legal practice. Does that sound about right?
It sounds very much like you're getting the story. And it's about access to the law and a democratizing process for the law to actually come down to the people again and not just be these kind of marble steps and Roman pillars and law books and scales of justice and wooden clubs and, you know, all that, but to actually make it more accessible to people.
But I'm just also saying, thinking about, so you're saying that, yes, the world is shifting due to this, partly due to this digitalization and that the law is changing and everything. Isn't it also the case that we're all bewildered by these changes, so that when I say we, I speak more as a part of the member of the public. So the public perception of what is just is shifting very quickly on these points as well, very field. So I'm thinking about 10 or 15 years ago, there was all this discussion about the defense agencies and the police use of web information to prevent crime, and then there was a general sentiment that was a bad thing, or at least in my circles
Sweden,
it was.
Yeah.
And then now more recently with the whole EncroChat evidence, it seems to be shifting in the opposite direction, right? So it's very, I think the public perception of what is good and just is changing also very quickly. So I think there's a place for researchers here to be acting as wise sounding boards for these kinds of debates.
Yep. But I think, and that is what democracy and the law is to be about. It's actually to, of course, we should reflect all these kind of changes, because that is what democracy and the law, according to what the people think, that's what the law should be. But we also need to, of course, be having this kind of stability and ensure that just because there's suddenly a popular kind of opinion toward something, that we don't violate the minority kind of interest or rights. So it also needs to be balanced, and we need to have these kind of strong institutions and kind of, the glue not making us run too fast. But with digitalization, we have the opportunity. We are suddenly now in a place where we could use innovation and we could use new mindset to kind of rethink what the law, what democracy, what all this should be about, the legal framework. And I'm not seeing that we take that too serious. And I think that if we don't do that, it is harmful, because, as I said, the courthouses, they are not equipped to handle these kind of... it's not a choice for them to digitalize or not, because it's not about their digitalization journey. It's for them to kind of handle the digitalization of the society. That's what's important. I mean, they can choose not to digitalize their kind of work processes. That doesn't matter. But they need to know about the external changes that comes with digitalization, the new legal areas that you talked about, and the new kind of evidence. Because, I mean, with the more advanced technology, suddenly we could have these kind of deep fake videos to serve as evidence, and the judge wouldn't be able to understand, is this real, is this fake, what is this kind of evidence? So photos or videos used as evidence. I was talking to a friend who's she's working for the police, and she's saying it's really hard now to get criminals convicted for the kind of, they are criminals doing stuff on with the bitcoins and all these kind of blockchain currencies. And it's hard because the judges don't really understand this when they present this as evidence, how they have done all these financial deals to finance the criminal activities. And so for lack of evidence, they are released. And she's like, but this was solid evidence. But I can't explain it to the judges because they haven't studied digitalization and economics for 6 years as I have. You know, it's really difficult to have that kind of competence at the courts, and it's in a lot of these areas that's popping up right now. So, it's an interesting but also terrifying area, in a way.
It's a good place to be as a researcher.
Yes.
No, I agree. I think that's a really pressing concern. For example, in the United States, there's a lot of controversy surrounding the use of algorithms and recognition, facial recognition technology, especially using algorithms even for criminal sentencing practices. And then that's become a bit of a famous case because there have been a lot of issues where judges have been using the algorithms which categorize criminals or people that have been accused of a crime. And then it does a categorization, and then the judges take that information and base their decision off of that algorithm, which is never the intent of the people who actually design the algorithm. But because the judges don't have the technical competence to understand the context of that algorithm and its proper use and its limitations, they take that algorithm into a whole new place. Yeah. So we talk about, I mean, for most of the past 45 minutes, we've been talking a lot about needing to make lawyers and people surrounding them in the legal practice, making them more technically aware. But then we also have to consider the issue that people that are making the technology and making these innovations, which seems to be a bigger issue with every passing year, that they also need to be a bit more legally aware. But since we're here today,
unintended consequences and ethical use and potentially also put that in some guidance toward that.
Well, now that's getting right to my point, because now that I keep hearing with digitalization in the law, and there always seems to be some sort of stereotypical easy point made against these old judges and that they can't get digitalization. So do you have any recommendations or any insights from your research? Because if we talk about digitalization and that is a much wider ranging, cross-cutting force in society, and that digitalization is happening and the law is always working with society, so this can't be avoided. So how can we make our judges be able to have some perspective on the algorithm? Or is this not an issue for the judges? Should we be hiring some more experts? How would you respond to that?
I think that's actually at the core of this. But I'm thinking what we started with talking about was this, is the court a space or is it a place? And if we consider now the court a space, maybe we could actually make some specific courts that handle these digital issues and, you know, ensure that those judges have the digital competence or colleagues that has that digital competence. So we could actually specialize the courts for that matter, I think. But we need to do something and we need to collaborate more. That I think is the kind of key message. And have these kind of conversations that we're having right now with the three of us having different competences and different entry points to this discussion, but still kind of agreeing that the discussion is valid and that we need to do something with it.
Yeah. Great. And do you have any recommendations for those of us with kids in Gothenburg or elsewhere in Sweden that might be worried about the algorithm telling them to go across the river every day? Because we can't all be lawyers, right?
I don't know, actually. I was gonna jokingly say move to Halland, but I think that a few families actually did that and move the kids to private schools. That's also good suggestions. And that's, but I mean, I truly hope that they learned their lesson and they will have a much better process next time and follow the law. I think, I mean, it can't be as bad as it was. And I think this year, I mean, those elections have been done and it's a lot better for the schools this year. It's not perfect, but it's better. So some light to the end here.
Yeah, exactly. And on that note, we have been talking about sort of case studies that are case studies because something that's gone wrong. But can you think of any regions or any examples beyond, say, Sweden or Brazil, where this digitalization of the law could be more of a shining example, something to learn more from? Is there any place where things are going perhaps a bit better? Or is this something that we're all countries, all regions are pretty much struggling with? No one has a very good answer.
I mean, I haven't seen that many good answers yet. I know that, I mean, both the UK and the US have come further than we have. But, I mean, you just pointed us towards some problems in the US legal space with this kind of issues and biases and faulty use of algorithms. So I don't really know if there is one country that's excelling in this area. I don't know. But let's find out. We are researchers, right?
It's that classic point of, you don't really notice technology when it works. It's only when it breaks down that exactly. You actually see it working.
Exactly, yeah.
So do you hope to continue to work on these issues, or is it back to the law for you? Because before you started your PhD,
academia. Yeah, I worked for 10 years as a lawyer before turning into academia. And I mean, that's why I learned about this issue of digitalization and how that kind of disrupted previous practices in law and previous kind of mindsets. And that's what made me interested in this line of conversations and inquiry. But yeah, I'm hoping to stay in academia. So I'm looking toward a postdoc somewhere with this area of digitalization, algorithmic decision making, ethics involved with that. And then, yeah, staying with academia. I think it's fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Lotta, for joining us today and also for being our very, very first guest for our first episode of this podcast. Thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you. I really enjoy this. I don't know much about this, but I feel like I know a bit more now. So thank you.
Thank you. It was great fun to speak with you.
And that's it for today. And stay tuned for more information about our next episode.
All right. So that was the first interview in this podcast series. The next ones might not be the exact same format. Who knows? But there will be more, right?
There will definitely be more. And we might even find some fancy music for all of you lovely listeners. But overall, we really hope that you enjoyed listening to the first episode of Disorganized and that you had some amount of fun in listening to the podcast. If not, maybe we were hoarding all of the fun ourselves when we get to record these lovely sessions and learn more about our colleagues' work and why what we do matters. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Until next time.
Until Bye. Next.